I'm Andrew Mackay, and I commanded the British and Coalition forces in Helmand in 2007 and 2008. The counterinsurgency campaign being fought in Helmand was recognised as the most complex the British had ever fought, and was being conducted against a backdrop of a campaign in Iraq that was not going well. During this tour, 8,500 troops that I commanded were also tasked to remove a large Taliban force that was controlling the strategic town of Musakala. The battle for Musakala was important in many ways, but for me personally, it began the journey of reflection and of what we had really achieved. Had we ever developed a coherent, doable strategy?
I was briefed several times on visits to Helmand, and I was concerned, as I was with other parts of Afghanistan. I wasn't sure we had a clear-cut strategy in terms of what we were trying to accomplish.
And whether or not our presence in Helmand really had made a difference.
Whatever we had in the last 13 years, whether it was prescribed by one partner or another, or jointly by many of them, it didn't work.
And perhaps, critically, would we ever secure a level of stability that, although rough around the edges, was going to be sustainable?
I'm not saying that the way in which we've gone about the campaign has not been without errors and mistakes, but I am saying that the sacrifice and the commitment has brought very real, tangible results.
This program sets out to try and answer some of those questions. Helmand should be the breadbasket for Afghanistan, but the Kajaki Dam in the north, holding back the snowmelt from the Hindu Kush, its central valley is incredibly fertile. Over many decades, an intricate series of irrigation waterways have been built that had somehow survived any amount of conflict. This area is known as the Green Zone. Step outside it to the west, east and south, and you are into hard, uncompromising desert. Add in Helmand's urban features, a series of medium and small towns, small villages, and even smaller settlements, and you have a tough, unforgiving terrain. It's a very challenging environment to live in, much less fight in. When I deployed to Helmand in September 2007, Kim Howells was a minister at the UK Foreign Office.
The first time I went to Lashkargah in Helmand province, we flew in an old ex-Soviet Mi-16 helicopter from Kandahar across the desert and landed in this kind of Bozhest fort. And when we landed, I said, "What's it like here?" And the colonel who was in charge of the Americans there, he said to me, "Well, sir, it ain't the end of the earth, but you can see it from here."
The enemy that was preparing to face British forces in Helmand was more than a collection of local tribesmen and drug lords. It was a resurgent and increasingly confident Taliban. Professor Theo Farrell from King's College London has written extensively about the counterinsurgency in Helmand.
The problem is that the Taliban had been sneaking back into Helmand, and we now know this. And so by the time the British arrived, Taliban plans to basically flood back into Helmand were well advanced. The Taliban launched a major offensive in the summer of 2006, literally pouring thousands of fighters across the border from Baluchistan, which is in Pakistan, into Helmand and into Kandahar to regain territory. It takes the British by surprise, but also it takes the Americans by surprise. Everyone's taken by surprise.
In the northern valleys of Helmand, those insurgents formed temporary allegiances with warlords and drug lords and went on the offensive. Trying to differentiate who was who within a population we barely understood meant all thoughts of reconstruction disappeared. The best of intentions quickly became overtaken by events. The British strategy, its plans, organisations and command structures that had been many months in the planning were torn up and reorganised.
One of the greatest errors of the campaign occurred right at the beginning. Very early on the tour, They were asked by the provincial governor, Governor Dowd, to send forces up to the northern towns of Nowzad, Sangin, and Musakala, because these towns were at risk of being overrun by insurgent forces. And so the brigadier in charge, he didn't have enough helicopters. And that's critical, because you need helicopters to resupply outposts. And so he faced a very difficult decision. And at the end of the day, he decided to deploy these small packages of troops into these northern towns. And this became known as the Platoon House Strategy.
British troops at war in southern Afghanistan. This was in the middle of a long and bloody summer. In 3 months, 33 British soldiers died.
We had no desire to put British troops up in Northern Helmand. It was absolutely not in the plan.
General David Richards had arrived as the commander of the International Stabilisation Assistance Force in July 2006.
Something I was very angry with. I inherited a relative dog's dinner. I mean, here, I don't want to sound critical, but when Governor Dowd said, well, we're not happy with that, the first thing that should have happened is they said, well, look, that's the deal. They should have been very robust with him, but they weren't.
Here in Sangin, as in other towns, they were defending a small compound, a symbol of government which came under siege.
Those seeking to lay their lives on the line and those responsible for leading them must understand why it is all necessary. I wanted to talk about this to former British military intelligence officer Frank Ledwidge. His book, Losing Small Wars, received considerable support from those at the coalface of conflict in Afghanistan, but considerably less support from those at the other end, the Ministry of Defence.
So there are some real basics that we failed to get a grip of. First, in Helmand, the history of the province. I remember talking to a paratrooper who had been deployed very early in the campaign. And he related going through on a patrol, a regular patrol, through the town of Gereshk, through the souk, the market of Gereshk. And one old man stopped him, through an interpreter, said, what are you doing here again? Are you here to burn the souk? And the soldier said, we haven't burnt your market, it's still here. You came through here in 1879 and you burned our market down. Have you come here to do it again? Now, we might regard that as some sort of amusing, diverting story. But actually, for Helmandis, that's not the case. They see us as vicious, serially rapacious, murderous invaders. And that surely is something that we could have considered and looked at before deciding on the deployment to Helmand.
As if fighting a complex counterinsurgency was not enough, we'd also fetched up in the province that supplies most of the world's opium and hence its heroin.
It's been another busy poppy harvest in Helmand. The opium gum scraped from the poppy bulbs will soon be turned into heroin and trafficked to the streets of Britain.
It must have seemed so simple at the 2001 Bonn conference that divided up authorities and responsibilities amongst the international coalition in Afghanistan. Anyone for justice? Thank you, Italy. Policing? Thank you, Germany. Sorting out the new Afghan army? Thank you, the US. Anyone for counter-narcotics? Thank you, Britain. Opium is a product tailor-made for poor infrastructure amidst conflict. For the Taliban, of course, it offered the one thing they need to sustain an insurgency, money. The reality of Britain's ownership of the counter-narcotics campaign in Afghanistan is that we never got round to determining a coherent strategy, much less resourcing one. Former US Defense Secretary Robert Gates struck me as one of the very few politicians to emerge from Afghanistan with their reputation enhanced. He has strong views on this.
What I kept repeating in the Situation Room at the White House was, if you go in and eradicate some guy's crop, you'd better have a fistful of money and a bag of seeds and some way for him to support his family until an alternative crop could mature. And then you had to figure out how to make up the differential in what he was getting paid to raise narcotics and what he might get paid to raise pomegranates or cotton. And we never got that part of it right. There was never enough civilians. There was never enough economic assistance. And my view was that every time we eradicated crops, we might as well have put up a recruitment poster for the Taliban.
So, poppy farming and opium production join a growing list of social and economic factors that we barely understood amidst a strategy we could not explain. Yet, the counter-narcotic strategy was the UK's responsibility, one that we had signed up to, one that we had declared we would lead, one we thought we could solve. I wanted to gain an Afghan perspective and talk to Mustafa Mastour, the current Deputy Minister of Finance. The United Kingdom took responsibility for counter-narcotics. Did they consult well enough?
Looking to the result, all our counter-narcotics policies failed. We spent the biggest share of the pie came to security, to the governance, and to counter-narcotics, while you see how poor those indicators are still, because Afghans were either not hurt or somehow pushed to implement those policies which may have worked in another country.
Do you think that we ever really learnt that lesson, that a prescriptive approach being applied in Afghanistan without genuine Afghan input, do you think that's a lesson we never really learnt?
To some extent, yes. Whatever we had in the last 13 years, whether it was prescribed by one partner or another, or jointly by many of them, it didn't work. The deployment of forces was not done based on an exact picture of what is happening in the field and not well calculated, and have cost us many of our citizens or soldiers' lives.
In September 2007, I deployed with 52 Brigade to Helmand. We were of the view that a coherent counterinsurgency strategy that placed the population at the centre of our efforts had yet to be defined. We felt that an overly aggressive approach and willingness to use large amounts of bullets and heavy ordnance had morphed into an approach of mowing the lawn.
Watch out! That's RPGs being fired.
This meant cutting down insurgents wherever they emerged and then returning to do it all over again once they had regrouped. In this environment, there was a sense that the body count of dead Taliban somehow mattered, when the reality was that it was of no consequence at all and was a particularly corrupt measurement of effectiveness. Frank Ledwidge again.
Some of your colleagues, Andrew, took great pride in the amount of ordnance, which is to say high explosive, lethally designed killing apparatus. The amount of ordnance used, they took pride in it. "I'm proud to report," said one, "that I have fired more ordnance than any other brigade before my own." Something of a body count approach. Now, when 52 Brigade arrived, I remember you saying that the next person who mentioned a body count would be going home the following day.
Our mantra became, the population is the prize. This would require much more emphasis on soft power and determining how we could influence the population to make the right choices. The opportunity to put this approach to the test came sooner than we anticipated, when we were tasked to retake the town of Musakala, a safe haven from which attacks into Helmand could be launched. Musakala was iconic for all the wrong reasons, and it had become an embarrassment to the international community. We set ourselves the aim of conducting the heavy fighting outside the town in order to persuade the population of about 15,000 people to return to their homes.
British forces were engaged in their biggest battle they've fought in Afghanistan so far. Now, after 4 days of fighting, much of the town has been recaptured from the Taliban.
Within days of recapturing Musakala, the population returned and the marketplace reopened. Somewhat controversially, we were determined that the first troops into Musakala would be those of the Afghan army. This meant the British and US forces, particularly the US forces, did the heavy fighting, but emphasis was placed on the Afghan army liberating the town. The significance of ensuring that the Afghans were the first forces into the town cannot be overstated. We were determined to make the Afghan security forces accept greater responsibility for the town, and that meant sharing the success of its recapture. No counterinsurgency has ever been successful unless there's an accompanying willingness to sit down and talk to the insurgent. After the physical and psychological defeat of the Taliban in Musakala, we were suddenly confronted by an excess of 200 hardened Taliban fighters seeking to come across to the government side. That effort failed. However, reconciliation talks with the Taliban should have begun well before the recapture of Musakala. In the aftermath of Musakala, Michael Semple tried to help me persuade those vanquished Taliban to change sides. Michael was a European Union representative at the time and has conducted numerous negotiations with the Taliban.
I think that it was not pursued either early enough or sufficiently seriously to deliver. Of course, people dabbled in it. I had an opportunity to do some of this, of the exploratory contacts. But now we can say that it was so important as to have warranted far more serious attention. A lot could have been achieved through those contacts to alert people inside the Taliban movement, both top leadership and also, interesting, I think, second line leadership, to the possibility of an accommodation and to the idea that the armed struggle that they were engaged in, as well as being extremely costly for them and the Afghan population, might actually be hurting their objectives rather than helping achieve them.
Did we ever really understand the Taliban?
I can say with confidence, no. And the reason I can say that so confidently is that I have reviewed briefings done, now, these days, right at the end of the intervention, by really quite senior experts working on the Taliban and briefing at a very high level, and can go through them point by point and say that, look, I've got very serious observations of the movement which directly contradict these things that you're confidently briefing on. One of us has got to be wrong.
Along with 52 Brigade, I left Helmand in April 2008. This marked the 2-year point in the Helmand campaign. By 2009, though, it was becoming very clear British forces in Helmand were overstretched and under-resourced for what they were being asked to do. Casualty rates reached all-time highs. Ends, ways and means were not aligned.
I have determined that it is in our vital national interest to send an additional 30,000 U.S. troops to Afghanistan.
The effect of this surge was to hand command of Helmand over to the U.S., who deployed 20,000 Marines into the province. The surge was also accompanied by a distinct change of direction in the counterinsurgency campaign, initiated by General Stanley McChrystal, who also decided to spend much more effort in getting the balance right in the application of both soft and hard power. The new strategy began to pay off.
I didn't think we got the inputs even roughly right in Afghanistan until late 2010. Right leaders, right units, right equipment, right infrastructure, everything else. It took us a very long time. It took us nearly 9 years to get to that point.
General David Petraeus was General McChrystal's replacement.
In the surge of 2010, 2011, our tasks were to halt the momentum of the Taliban. Remember, it was on the march. It was basically just continuing to expand its areas at the expense of coalition and Afghan forces. So we had to halt that momentum. And this would create the space and the time to enable the accelerated development of Afghan security forces and institutions, and that would in turn allow us to begin transition.
I think the British people deserve a deadline, because we've been in Helmand province since 2006, we've been in Afghanistan militarily since 2001. I believe the Afghan government, the Afghan people, the Afghan army actually deserve to have a deadline so they can plan properly towards transition.
So, by mid-2012, a withdrawal date was set for the end of this year. I, like many others, began to ponder what the gains in Helmand had been and whether or not the effort had been worthwhile. Over 450 British soldiers and many more coalition and Afghan soldiers and civilian lives had been lost. And if that was worthwhile, what were the reasons that made it so? A theme I addressed with many people was the thorny issue of whether or not we'd ever developed a clear strategy for Afghanistan. I put this to David Miliband, who became Britain's Foreign Secretary shortly before I deployed to Helmand.
I think that the clarity of mission came from a determination never to allow Al-Qaeda to re-establish itself in the badlands of the south and east of Afghanistan. The words on paper about a military campaign, a development drive, a governance drive situated within a wider political context were clear, but there were two factors that interrupted or mitigated the development of that strategy in practice. Britain was part of a wider coalition to over 30 countries involved. Secondly, the campaign over 10 plus years obviously had twists and turns. And so I think that those two factors got in the way of the implementation of the strategy. That's not to deny that significant progress was made in a wide range of areas. But obviously, given the loss of life, given the challenges that Afghanistan still faces, it's imperative that one learns the right lessons.
I also wanted to speak to General John McColl, who I had served with in Iraq, but who had, as a major general, commanded the British military forces who deployed into Afghanistan in 2001, when Kabul was recaptured and the Taliban had been routed. If anyone was going to be able to have a long-term perspective, it was going to be him.
There was nothing in Afghanistan. It was a completely failed state that had been at war for two decades. We've had the growth of GDP from 2.5 billion in 2001 and 2011, 17 billion. We've had a democratic process. We've had elections in 2004, 2009 and 2014. And growth in health from 10% to 85%, having access to basic health care. We have education now, 6 million, it was 1 million back in 2001. Now, none of this progress would have been possible were it not for the deployment of an international military presence. I'm not saying that the way in which we've gone about the campaign has not been without errors and mistakes, but I am saying that the sacrifice and the commitment has brought very real, tangible results.
But these gains have come at a high price. The cost in blood and treasure, the tens of billions spent. Yet, if Afghanistan could prosper in an uncertain future and with our continued support, could it still remain a worthwhile and noble cause? Minister Mustafa Mastour will continue to live with that uncertainty.
There are hopes as well as challenges. You know that 50% of our population is under 15 years of age and 65% of the population is under 25 years of age. So it means that this is a great hope. The natural resources is under exploration. So we have potential for growth, for economic investment. The location of Afghanistan is another God-given gift to us.
The extent to which you have an economy that's been pretty reliant on conflict, presumably without that continued resourcing and support, your best hopes would unlikely to materialize.
That's right. We need international support at least for more two decades. At this moment, the international assistance is 90% size of our GDP, but if we want to reduce it gradually up to 2030, then we need assistance.
In the many interviews I conducted for this BBC programme, a constant theme was one of continuing to support Afghanistan and its new president in order not to squander all that has been invested in it so far. Robert Gates sums this up well.
The decision, both on the part of ourselves and our NATO partners and the Afghans, and continuing assistance to Afghanistan is critical. I think it's an important signal of our willingness to remain engaged with the country, that the Taliban is going to continue to confront us, partnering with the Afghans. The Afghans are not going to be left there all by themselves. I think a very great deal rides on this residual presence. And if we have it, I'm reasonably optimistic. If we don't, I'm fairly pessimistic.
I believe that whoever you are when you go into an extreme environment such as Helmand, it's not the same person who returns. It is impossible to distance and compartmentalize such an experience. For my part, I resigned from the British Army in 2010. I have often been asked whether or not we were winning or if victory was within our grasp. I would say that I believed we could succeed in Helmand. Winning or victory was not the purpose of our presence. It was too absolute and implied that there must be a loser. Success in these terms still eludes us, when the stakes in Libya, Syria, and Iraq could not be higher. I am Andrew Mackay, and you've been listening to The Lessons of War.